Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. At first glance, John's resume seemed innocent enough. Under experience, it stated that he had been in charge of major projects in the United States, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East, and it provided a laundry list of the types of projects: development planning, economic forecasting, energy demand forecasting, and so on. This section ended by describing his Peace Corps work in Ecuador. However, it omitted any reference to the Peace Corps itself, leaving the impression that he had been the professional manager of a construction materials company instead of a volunteer assisting a small cooperative composed of illiterate Andean peasant brick makers. Following that in the resume was a long list of clients. This included the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the official name of the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the government of Kuwait, the Iranian Ministry of Energy, the Arabian American Oil Company of Saudi Arabia, Instituto de Recursos Hidráulicos y Electrificación, Peru Sahan Umam District, Nicaragua, and many others. But the one that caught John's attention was the final entry, U.S. Treasury Department, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. He was amazed that such a listing had ever made it to print, even though it was obviously part of his file. Setting aside the resume for a moment, John turned to the Mainline's article. He clearly recalled his interview with its author, a very talented and well-intentioned young woman. She had given it to him for his approval before publishing it. John remembered feeling gratified that she had painted such a flattering portrait of him, and he immediately approved it. Once again, the responsibility fell on his shoulders. The article began, quote, "Looking over the faces behind the desks, it's easy to tell that economics and regional planning is one of the most recently formed and rapidly growing disciplines at Maine. While several people were influential in getting the economics group started, it basically came about through the efforts of one man, John Perkins, who is now head of the group. Hired as an assistant to the head load forecaster in January 1971, John was one of the few economists working for Maine at the time. For his first assignment, he was sent as part of an 11-man team to do an electricity demand study in Indonesia, end quote. The article briefly summarized his previous work history, described how John had spent 3 years in Ecuador, and then continued with the following, quote, "It was during this time that John Perkins met Einar Grieve, a former employee. He had since left Maine to become president of the Tucson Gas and Electric Company, who was working in the town of Paute, Ecuador, on a hydroelectric project for Maine. The two became friendly, and through continual correspondence, John was offered a position with Maine. About a year later, John became the head load forecaster, and as the demands from clients and institutions, such as the World Bank, grew, he realized that more economists were needed at Maine," end quote. None of the statements in either document were outright lies. The backup for both documents was on the record in his file. However, they conveyed a perception that John now found to be twisted and sanitized. And in a culture that worships official documents, they perpetuated something that was even more sinister. Outright lies can be refuted. Documents like these, too, were impossible to refute because they were based on glimmers of truth, not open deceptions, and because they were produced by a corporation that had earned the trust of other corporations, international banks, and governments. This was essentially true of the resume because it was an official document, as opposed to the article, which was a bylined interview in a magazine. The Maine logo, appearing on the bottom of the resume and on the covers of all the proposals and reports that resume was likely to grace, carried a lot of weight in the world of international business. It was a seal of authenticity that elicited the same level of confidence as those stamped on diplomas and framed certificates hanging in doctors' and lawyers' offices. These documents portray John as a very competent economist, head of a department at a prestigious consulting firm, who was traveling around the globe conducting a broad range of studies that would make the world a more civilized and prosperous place. The deception was not in what was stated, but in what was omitted. If John put on an outsider's hat, took a purely objective look, he had to admit that those omissions raised many questions. For example, there was no mention of his recruitment by the NSA or of Einar Grieve's connection with the Army in his role as an NSA liaison. There obviously was no discussion of the fact that John had been under tremendous pressure to produce highly inflated economic forecasts, or that much of his job revolved around arranging huge loans that countries like Indonesia and Panama could never repay. There was no praise for the integrity of his predecessor, Howard Parker, nor any acknowledgement that John became the head load forecaster because he was willing to provide the biased studies expected of him, rather than, like Howard, saying what John believed was true and getting fired as a result. Most puzzling was that final entry under the list of my clients, U.S. Treasury Department, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And I will return to the story after a brief station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, John kept returning to that line, and he wondered how people would interpret it. They might well ask, what is the connection between the U.S. Department of the Treasury and Saudi Arabia? Perhaps some would take it as a typo, two separate lines erroneously compressed into one. Most readers, though, would never guess the truth that it had been included for a specific reason. It was there so that those in the inner circle of the world, where John operated, would understand that he had been part of the team that crafted the deal of the century, the deal that changed the course of world history but never reached the newspapers. John helped create a covenant that guaranteed continued oil for America, safeguarded the rule of the House of Saud, and assisted in the financing of Osama bin Laden and the protection of international criminals like Uganda's Idi Amin. That single line in his resume spoke to those in the know. It said that Maine's chief economist was a man who could deliver. The final paragraph of the Maine Lines article was a personal observation by the author, and it struck a raw nerve. Quote, "The expansion of economics and regional planning has been fast-paced, yet John feels he has been lucky in that each individual hired has been a hard-working professional. As he spoke to me from across his desk, the interest and support he holds for his staff was evident and admirable." End quote. The fact was that John had never thought of himself as a bona fide economist. He had graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration from Boston University, emphasis on marketing. He had always been lousy in mathematics and statistics. At Middlebury College, John had majored in American literature. Writing had come easily to him. His status as chief economist and as manager of economics and regional planning could not be attributed to his capabilities in either economics or planning. Rather, it was a function of his willingness to provide the types of studies and conclusions his bosses and clients wanted, combined with a natural acumen for persuading others through the written word. In addition, John was clever enough to hire very competent people, many with master's degrees and a couple with PhDs, acquiring a staff who knew a whole lot more about the technicalities of his business than John did. Small wonder that the author of that article concluded that the interest and support he holds for his staff was evident and admirable. John kept these two documents and several other similar ones in the top drawer of his desk, and he returned to them frequently. Afterward, he sometimes found himself outside his office, wandering among the desks of his staff, looking at those men and women who worked for him, and feeling guilty about what he had done to them, and about the role they all played in widening the gap between the rich and poor. John thought about the people who starved each day while his staff and he slept in first-class hotels, ate at the finest restaurants, and built up their financial portfolios. John thought about the fact that the people he trained had now joined the ranks of economic hitmen. He had brought them in. He had recruited them and trained them. But it had not been the same as when he joined. The world had shifted and the corporatocracy had progressed. They had gotten better or more pernicious. The people who worked for John were a different breed from him. There had been no NSA polygraphs or Claudines in their lives. No one had spelled it out for them what they were expected to do to carry on the mission of the global empire. They had never heard the term economic hitman or even EHM, nor had they been told they were in for life. They simply had learned from John's example and from his system of rewards and punishments. They knew that they were expected to produce the types of studies and results he wanted. Their salaries, Christmas bonuses, indeed their very jobs, depended on pleasing John. John, of course, had done everything he could imagine to lighten their burden. He had written papers, given lectures, and taken every possible opportunity to convince them of the importance of optimistic forecasts, of huge loans, of infusions of capital that would spur GNP growth and make the world a better place. it had required less than a decade to arrive at this point where the seduction, the coercion, had taken a much more subtle form, a sort of gentle style of brainwashing. Now these men and women who sat at desks outside his office overlooking Boston's Back Bay were going out into the world to advance the cause of global empire. In a very real sense, John had created them, even as Claudine had created him. But unlike John, they had been kept in the dark. Many nights John lay awake, thinking, fretting about these things. Paula's reference to his resume had opened a Pandora's box, and John often felt jealous of his employees for their naivete. He had intentionally deceived them, and in doing so, had protected them from their own consciences. They did not have to struggle with the moral issues that haunted John. John also thought a great deal about the idea of integrity in business and appearances versus reality. Certainly, he told himself, people have deceived each other since the beginning of history. Legend and folklore are full of tales about distorted truths and fraudulent deals. Cheating rug merchants, usurious money lenders, and tailors willing to convince the emperor that his clothes are invisible only to him. However, much as John wanted to conclude that things were the same as they always had been, that the facade of his main resume and the reality behind it were merely reflections of human nature, he knew in his heart this was not the case. Things had changed. John now understood that they have reached a new level of deception, one that will lead to their own destruction, not only morally, but also physically, as a culture, unless they make significant changes soon. The example of organized crime seemed to offer a metaphor. Mafia bosses often start out as street thugs, but over time, the ones who make it to the top transform their appearance. They take to wearing impeccably tailored suits, owning legitimate businesses, and wrapping themselves in the cloak of upstanding society. They support local charities and are respected by their communities. They are quick to lend money to those in desperate straits. Like the John Perkins in the main resume, these men appeared to be model citizens. However, beneath this patina is a trail of blood. When the debtors cannot pay, hitmen move in to demand their pound of flesh. If this is not granted, the jackals close in with baseball bats. Finally, as a last resort, out come the guns. John realized that his gloss as chief economist, head of economics and regional planning, was not the simple deception of a rug dealer. Not something of which a buyer can beware. It was part of a sinister system aimed not at outfoxing an unsuspecting customer, but rather at promoting the most subtle and effective form of imperialism the world has ever known. Every one of the people on his staff also held a title: financial analyst, sociologist, economist, lead economist, econometrician, shadow pricing expert, and so forth, and yet none of those titles indicated that every one of them was, in his or her own way, an economic hitman, that every one of them was serving the interests of global empire. And the story will continue after station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Nor did the fact of those titles among John's staff suggest that they were just the tip of the iceberg. Every major international company, from ones that marketed shoes and sporting goods to those that manufactured heavy equipment, had its own EHM equivalents. The march had begun, and it was rapidly encircling the planet. The hoods had discarded their leather jackets, dressed up in business suits, and taken on an air of respectability. Men and women were descending from corporate headquarters in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, London, and Tokyo, streaming across every continent to convince corrupt politicians to allow their countries to be shackled to the corporatocracy and to induce desperate people to sell their bodies to sweatshops and assembly lines. It was disturbing to understand that the unspoken details behind the written words of his resume and of that article defined a world of smoke and mirrors intended to keep them all shackled to a system that is morally repugnant and ultimately self-destructive. By getting John to read between the lines, Paula had nudged him to take one more step along a path that would ultimately transform his life. John's work in Colombia and Panama gave him many opportunities to stay in touch with and to visit the first country to be his home away from home. Ecuador had suffered under a long line of dictators and right-wing oligarchies manipulated by U.S. political and commercial interests. In a way, the country was the quintessential banana republic, and the corporatocracy had made major inroads there. The serious exploitation of oil in the Ecuadorian Amazon basin began in the late 1960s, and it resulted in a buying spree in which the small club of families who ran Ecuador played into the hands of the international banks. They saddled their country with huge amounts of debt, backed by the promise of oil revenues. Roads and industrial parks, hydroelectric dams, transmission and distribution systems, and other power projects sprang up all over the country. International engineering and construction companies struck it rich once again. One man whose star was rising over this Andean country was the exception to the rule of political corruption and complicity with the corporatocracy. Jaime Roldos was a university professor and attorney in his late 30s, whom John had met on several occasions. Jaime was charismatic and charming. Once John impetuously offered to fly to Quito and provide free consulting services anytime he asked. John said it partially in jest, but also because he would gladly have done it on his own vacation time. John liked him and, as John was quick to tell him, was always looking for a good excuse to visit his country. Jaime laughed and offered John a similar deal, saying that whenever John needed to negotiate his oil bill, he could call on Jaime. Jaime had established a reputation as a populist and a nationalist, a person who believed strongly in the rights of the poor and in the responsibility of politicians to use a country's natural resources prudently. When he began campaigning for a presidency in 1978, he captured the attention of his countrymen and of citizens in every nation where foreign interests exploited oil, or where people desired independence from the influences of powerful outside forces. Roldos was the rare modern politician who was not afraid to oppose the status quo. He went after the oil companies and the not-so-subtle system that supported them. For instance, John heard that he accused the Summer Institute of Linguistics, the SIL, an evangelical missionary group from the United States, of sinister collusion with the oil companies. John was familiar with SIL missionaries from his Peace Corps days. The organization had entered Ecuador, as it had so many other countries, with the professional goal of studying, recording, and translating indigenous languages. SIL had been working extensively with the Huayrani tribe in the Amazon basin area during the early years of oil exploration when a disturbing pattern appeared to emerge. While it might have been a coincidence, and no link was ever proved, stories were told in many Amazonian communities that when seismologists reported to corporate headquarters that a certain region had characteristics indicating a high probability of oil beneath the surface, some SIL members went in and encouraged the indigenous people to move from that land onto the missionary reservations. There they would receive free food, shelter, clothes, medical treatment, and missionary-style education. The condition was that, according to these stories, they had to deed their lands to the oil companies. Rumors abounded that SIL missionaries used an assortment of underhanded techniques to persuade the tribes to abandon their homes and move to the missions. A frequently repeated story was that they had donated food heavily laced with laxatives, then offered medicines to cure the diarrhea epidemic. Throughout the Huarani territory, SIL airdropped false-bottomed food baskets containing tiny radio transmitters. The rumor was that receivers at highly sophisticated communications stations manned by U.S. military personnel at the Army base in Shell tuned in to these transmitters. Whenever a member of the tribe was bitten by a poisonous snake or became seriously ill, an SIL representative arrived with anti-venom or the proper medicines, often in oil company helicopters. During the early days of oil exploration, five missionaries were found dead with Huarani spears protruding from their bodies. Later, the Huaranis claimed they did this to send a message to keep missionaries out. The message went unheeded. In fact, it ultimately had the opposite effect. Rachel Saint, the sister of one of the murdered men, toured the United States, appearing on national television in order to raise money and support for SIL and the oil companies, who she claimed were helping the savages become civilized and educated. According to some sources, SIL received funding from the Rockefeller Charities. Family scion John D. Rockefeller had founded Standard Oil, which later divested into the majors, including Chevron, Exxon, and Mobil. Roldo struck John as a man who walked the path blazed by Torrijos. Both stood up to the world's strongest superpower. Torrijos wanted to take back the canal, while Roldos's strongly nationalistic position on oil threatened the world's most influential companies. Like Torrijos, Roldos was not a communist, but rather stood for the right of his country to determine its own destiny. And as they had with Torrijos, pundits predicted that big business in Washington would never tolerate Roldos as president, that if elected, he would meet a fate similar to that of Guatemala's Arbenz or Chile's Allende. It seemed to John that the two men together might spearhead a new movement in Latin American politics, and that this movement might form the foundation of changes that could affect every nation on the planet. These men were not Castros or Gaddafis. They were not associated with Russia or China, or, as in Allende's case, with the international socialist movement. They were popular, intelligent, charismatic leaders who were pragmatic instead of dogmatic. They were nationalistic, but not anti-American. If corporatocracy was built on three pillars, major corporations, international banks, and colluding governments, Roldos and Torrijos held out the possibility of removing the pillar of government collusion. And we will continue the story in the next show of Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.